multi-currency term and revolving facilities agreement. We're looking at one of the most important standard documentation in the international finance area. This is used in a market worth between $90 and $100 trillion. This establishes the standard terms and conditions which almost all other law firms, banks and financial institutions will apply, and in almost all other financial centres and in almost all other types of related finance facility, whether it's in property finance, acquisition finance, project finance or whatever else. This establishes a core set of rights and duties, obligations and liabilities for the parties in these markets, which means that we can understand, manage and control and regulate the structure and operation of the markets without any separate outside external management. How does this work? What we'll see from the joint statement at the very beginning is they're referred to as the primary documents. This is an investment grade document. It's prepared by the core trade association. What we'll see is this: the Loan Market Association came together with the British Bankers Association and the Association of Corporate Treasurers and Major City Law Firms, specifically Allen and Overy and Clifford Chance, and they looked at the last 10, 20 years of practice, market practice, and tried to develop the most appropriate, consolidated, perfect, well-drafted set of standard documentation for use in this market going forward. I've explained separately the advantages of the LMA model and the background to the LMA itself, which was originally set up in 1996 and is based down in Canary Wharf in London. I've given you a separate summary and outline of the document. What we want to try and do now is work through some of the core standard provisions in this. What do we have? This is the core outline, although I've provided my own separate model, which summarises all of the key provisions on one page front and back, as well as highlight the core key sets of provisions in terms of the financial clauses, the obligations, and the defaults. What have we got? This agreement is entered into by the company, that's the principal borrower. We then have the subsidiaries, which is defined in the Companies Act, and we'll see that later. Some of the references might be to the old Companies Act 1985, although that's now replaced and restated by the Companies Act 2006. It's very easy to get correlation provisions, so you can simply replace the clauses. In moving from the 85 to the 2006, there was very little actual change of law made. Many of the original provisions in the Companies Act were simply copied over. They just have slightly different numbers, and we just have to make sure that the relevant provisions are mentioned. So, for example, on the definition of subsidiary, it's no longer Section 736 of the Companies Act 85, it's Section 1159. But I've marked that up in the provisions that I'm giving you. We have the company, we have the subsidiaries, who are the original borrowers, and then we also have the original guarantors, each company guaranteeing each other, and we will take resolutions to confirm it's in the commercial interest of each company to do so. We have a lead bank or an arranging bank, we have the original lenders, and then we have the agent bank. We have references to original because we can bring in other parties when parties leave, and we have provisions for transfer, accession, and resignation in the schedules. There are core sets of provisions then set out in the definitions in section 1.1 and in the construction provisions in section 1.2. Many of the key clauses we can only understand by going back to the core definitions. So we have, for example, the availability period during which the facility A and the facility B will be available for drawdown. We need to watch that because the borrowers need to draw down during the period. They are going to pay a commitment fee in the clauses. We will see that in section 12.1. The commitment fee applies to the whole of the facility, although they will also pay the relevant interest in 9.1 as they draw down under either the A or the B. So we need to look at the availability period and the availability commitment. The commitment is each of the bank's proportionate contribution to the facility. The banks will be listed in Schedule 1, And there'll be a column in Schedule 1 specifying their commitment, which basically establishes their proportionate responsibility under the documentation. Although what we will see is that the banks are lending as principal and on a several, not a joint and several basis, and that's set out in Section 2.1a. Other key provisions include, for example, the base currency. There will always be an agreed base currency against which all other calculations will be made. So if there's a change in currency, it all goes back to the base. If there's no alternative currency available, the default position goes back to payment in the base currency. We have the break costs, which apply where there has been some prepayment. The borrowers have to pay the difference between what the banks expected, which is the margin in 9.1b, as against putting the funds back into the interbank markets. They just returned the markets because that's where they drew the markets from in the first case. The banks participating in these markets do not have to have, for example, in the specific type of transaction we looked at before, if we have one company and nine subsidiaries, so there's 10 borrowers. If we have 10 banks lending 100 million, each of the banks can then put up 10 million each. It doesn't have to be in equal proportions, but it can be, and for our purposes, it will be. What then happens is this: the banks don't have to have $10 million available. All that will happen is when one of the borrowers wants to draw down, it issues a utilization request under Section 5.1 and Schedule 3. The agent bank notifies the bank how much is required, when it's required, and into what account is to be paid. Only at that stage will the agent bank, will the lead, the syndicate member bank, then have to go into the market to draw down the funds. If it's not got them available already, only then does it need to go and borrow them and draw them down, and only up to the amount set out in the utilization request. This isn't like a deposit market where the banks have to have the funds available at all times. They only have to draw down themselves in the interbank market when they receive a notice of utilization from the agent bank, which has been served by one of the lending banks. So with the break costs, all that happens is the banks can replace, because they've received the funds early from the borrower, they can replace that back into the markets and generate whatever the daily free rate is, for example, SONIA. So the banks will then profit from that. The borrower only has to pay the difference between the risk-free rate on the local interbank market and the margin that is otherwise expected. You need to watch your business day. In certain financial centres, the business day changes. In Hong Kong, business day includes Saturday. The commitments, you have commitment A and commitment B. We'll see later. We define the loan at loan, L-O-A-N, capital L, is a facility A loan and a facility B loan. This raises a subtle legal issue to the extent that we also have the provision in Section 2.2b, whereas the obligations are separate. So the question is, how many loans can be issued under this? Is it only the facility A and B, which means each of the borrowers are drawing down a loan against the banks collectively, or do we also, to calculate the total number of loans, have to multiply the banks as well? Legally, the figure of total capital L loans is the total number of A and B facilities, so that each time a borrower draws down, that becomes an independent loan. If you wanted to calculate the total number of obligations outstanding, loans with a lowercase l, it would be multiplied by the total number of banks as well, because each one of those is several, and each set of rights and obligations are separate and independent from Section 2.2b. Confidentiality undertaken is set out in Schedule 10 and Schedule 11 in our model. Default, we need to always check the default clauses. We're going to confirm the financials, the obligations, and the defaults, and we need to make sure all of this ties together. We need to be very clear about this. If there's separate other terms then incorporated, such as a disruption event, we need to know the terms of that as well. This principally arises with regards to, for example, when we can't obtain the relevant rates. For example, the screen rates for the interbank market will have alternative clauses dealing with all of this as well. We're going to confirm each of these definitions as we work through section 1.1. The easiest way to do this is to build in the cross references to the core clauses. It's unfortunate this is not provided here. I incorporate it into my separate outline. So we'll see there facility A, facility B, facility A commitment, B commitment. There's the definition of lender, interest, interest period, holding company. We now take that back to the Companies Act 2006 rather than the 1985. LIBOR, we now replace by the local interbank free risk rate. Financial indebtedness, we need to watch that. There's a definition specifically of indebtedness, and then we'll see again that indebtedness is reused in the construction provision in 1.2, so we need to read those two together. You need to see how all of the different provisions cross-refer and build up to create a total living, dynamic set of information provisions and clauses which will govern the relationship between the parties during the whole term that the facility is in operation. We have a reference to the information memorandum. The information memorandum sets out the background to the borrower, the borrower's business, its history, its operations, how it will apply the loans, and how it will repay the loans. All of that will be set out in the information memorandum. This corresponds with a prospectus in a bond deal, which also corresponds, is in almost identical terms, to the listing particulars where we try to apply for this to be listed on one of the major international stock markets and exchanges. You'll see at the bottom there, there's a reference to GAAP. GAAP are the general accounting provisions which are adopted by the SEC in the United States. The GAAP are the GAAP clauses. GAAP was originally, it's provided by the... It's the Financial Accounting Standards Board, the FASB, which maintains what we call the Accounting Standards Codification, the ASC, in the United States. There's background to this. Originally, the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants was set up in 1887. It becomes the Committee of Accounts Procedure, the CAP, in 1939. It's replaced by the Accounting Principles Board, the APB, in 1959. Which then becomes the FASB that we've mentioned in 1973. The problem that we have at the international level is that US documents are determined by the GAAP, Generally Accepted Accounting Principles, whereas international standards are governed by the International Financial Reporting Standards, the IFRS. The IFRS, they're issued by the IASB, is the International Accounting Standards Board. It was originally set up in 1973, renamed in 2001. The US GAAP is essentially rules-based. The international IFRS, which is based in London, is principles-based. There was an issue because the United States companies have to comply with GAAP because the SEC, Securities and Exchange Commission, applies GAAP and requires that in all of its obligations, whereas international transactions prefer and want to use the IFRS. They attempted a convergence program. They had a convergence project in 2006. They spent quite a lot of time working on this, maybe 10 years. It didn't quite work. They didn't get as far as they wanted. And eventually the SEC announced on 5 January 2017 that it will continue to have international transactions governed either by GAAP or the IFRS, depending upon the particular circumstances. So this is an issue for practice. It's not really important from a legal perspective, but we need to understand that the relevant accounting standards which determine the structure, content and operation of the financial statements that will apply in any particular deal can either be US-based or international-based. They tried to converge them, but they abandoned that in 2017. You just need to make sure your clients are aware of that and that they can provide the relevant documentation in the appropriate format. The mandatory cost formula, that's our regulatory charge, which will be imposed by the local central bank or regulated authority. It's a very small amount. The point simply is this: by making available this facility, for example, $10 million for each $10 million for each of the banks concerned, that increases their total liabilities in the market, against which the local central bank or regulator calculates its regulatory operational charge. It can be quite a small amount, 0.04% was the Bank of England figure. However, because the bank has to pay that, it simply transfers that back onto the borrower, and we'll see that in section 9.1c. Again, you need to watch key terms like a month, as we mentioned, a business day. It's very easy to miss payments. If you pay a day late, that can constitute an event of default, which can trigger cross default. You have to watch this, and your clients have to be aware of it. You have to check every provision, every clause. So what's a business day? What's a month? What's a calendar year? All of these terms can vary in different agreements. You need to be very careful about this. An obligor is then the collective term for the borrower and the guarantor. Optional currencies, reference banks, repeating representations. So we have representations. These are sometimes called evergreens, that they apply on a continuing basis or that they're repeated. What we will see is utilization under 5.1. We can serve a utilization notice if all the CPs have been satisfied and there's no event of default. So that effectively repeats each time we have a drawdown. Rollover loans, that applies with regards to the Bs. We can draw down, repay, draw down again. The principal A, we draw down, we repay, we cannot draw down again. This is provided for in express provisions. Target refers to the European, trans-European automated real-time gross settlement express transfer system. Essentially, you have the CHAPS system in London for large volume interbank sterling payments. You have the CHIPS system in New York for large volume interbank dollar payments. And for large volume euro payments, you have Target. And then now Target 2 for security settlement. So I mentioned already, with separate construction clauses, you need to read these as well so that we can understand how all of these terms are used in particular cases. I think the best way to summarise it is that the terms are specified in the particular definitions, and then their use and application is clarified, expanded on in the construction provisions clauses in 1.2, and then we'll disapply creation of third-party rights in 1.3. What we then have are the facilities. We have a multi-currency term loan and a multi-currency revolver, which simply means we have a fixed term for the A facility and a revolving B for the B, as well as each of those can change currencies at any time at the borrower's election. The finance parties and obligations, this is very important. The obligations of the finance parties are several. They're not joint and several. And because of that, you'll see clarification in the second sentence in 2.2a. No finance party is responsible for the obligations of another. No finance party has to step in and cover any gap left if any of the other parties do not make available their proportionate facility under the system. 2.2b, the rights are separate and independent, and also the obligations are separate and independent. And any debt arising under the finance documents to a finance party from an obligor shall be separate and independent debt. As I said before, you can calculate the total number of loans, capital L, in terms of facility A, facility B, treating the lenders as a group. But if you're calculating total indebtedness, independent debts, it's actually that times 10. So that goes to, as we've said in the example we provided before, up to 26,400 separate debts or loans under this facility. We also specifically specify that they're separate and independent, so the banks can enforce separately. We don't need what's called joinder, where you have to bring in another bank to raise the action, but also we can have separate enforcement under C. So the obligations are separate and independent under A, rights and debt separate and independent under B, so we can sue separately, and then C, we can enforce separately as well. However, that's then subject to the pari passu provisions in 28. We just need specifically to watch the terms of the exceptions to the pari passu in 28.5. And we'll come on and look at that in further detail. Purpose. Most euro dollar deals will not have a purpose. This will be common in, for example, a project finance deal, a project property finance deal, acquisition finance deal. even if there is a purpose, there's no monitoring. How do we incorporate the obligations? The CPs are built in, embedded by tying in the service of a utilization, a drawdown under 4.1 to ensure that the CPs have all been provided and that there's no event of default. And we'll see that in 4.1 and in 4.2. So that all the CPs have to have been provided and no default with any repeating representations also complied with. That's how we incorporate the obligations. The borrowers can only draw down once all of this is satisfied. We then need to check Schedule 2 for the CPs, and I've incorporated them separately into my outline. There may be further additional conditions precedent, and then any other separate obligations with regards to alternative loans, and then the maximum number of loans. This loan clause total aggregate provision in 4.4 applies to the total number of A's and B's. So that's not multiplied by the total number of banks, but if we want to calculate the total number of debts outstanding, we also multiply that by the banks. The borrowers just need to monitor this. If, for example, there's only 1,000 facility A and B together, it can't draw more. What it could do is it could try and combine, so we have divisibility and consolidation, and we'll see how that operates as well in the later provisions. In 10.4, we can consolidate debts and we can divide debts. But we can't do that in excess of the total limit, and that's provided for under 4.4. Utilisation in 5.1. The utilisation form standard template is provided for in 3. That's used under 5.1. We complete the form under 5.2. It identifies the facility, A or B. It identifies the date, the currency, interest period. Only one loan is drawn down under each drawdown, each utilization, and it's irrevocable. And then we just have additional provisions on the nature and operation of this. Lenders are responsible for their commitments, as set out in Schedule 1. We can switch currencies. We can elect by changing the terms of the utilization. The utilization is also caused, it can be called a selection notice, and we'll see that in Schedule 3. You can select the currency and the change the interest periods. It's basically the same thing. It's just when you're making a slightly different notification to the agent bank. Where there's unavailability of a currency, there's procedures for obtaining a separate currency. Otherwise, you go back to the default, which is the base currency. All the calculations are made by the agent bank, and I provide for this in my chapter. I've summarised all of the duties of the agent bank in terms of receipt duties, notification duties, banking duties, which are the calculation duties, and other provisions. We then have core clauses on repayment. So utilization determines drawdown. We then have repayment and prepayment. And we need to look at the specific provisions for this. We will repay A. Once the repay A has been repaid, we cannot draw down again. So no borrower may reborrow under a facility A. That's in 7.1B. We can repay a B and then draw down again. We have specific provisions on prepayment. There has to be mandatory prepayment in the event of an illegality or a change of control. This is effectively a sort of form of indirect default. And we'll see change of business and protecting of assets in the defaults and in the covenants later. So you'll begin to see how a lot of these clauses overlap with each other. But it's automatically treated as a prepayment situation and a repayment, automatic repayment, if there's illegality or change of control. The main provision that applies here is that the banks will have to pay the break costs in the event of a prepayment. There is voluntary prepayment on consent and additional provisions with regards to this incorporated in the provisions. Interestingly enough, 8.7c, no borrower may reborrow any facility A which has been prepaid. That seems to repeat the provision we looked at before, when you can't draw down again, which is on 7.1b, although that's a repayment and a prepayment. Slightly different in law. That was why they added a separate clause to that effect. You'll see the break costs there are in 8.7b, and then that's going to be built up and restated again subsequently. Cost of utilization. What does the borrower pay? The borrower pays under 9.1 the margin, the local risk-free rate. In our example, it would be SONIA, the sterling overnight interest average in London. It might be SOFR in New York, Euribor, Ester, or Ionia in Europe, and TIBOR in Tokyo, SHIBOR in Shanghai, MIBOR in Mumbai. And then the mandatory cost of the regulatory cost, and we looked at the definition already. Payment of interest will be in arrears at the end of each interest period. The interest period we can vary, although there's a default provision. You will see that in 10.1. Changes to interest period in 2, we can give that effect to through a selection notice if necessary. You need to watch your non-business days again, so check your definitions. And then we can consolidate and divide facility A's but not B's. That's in 10.4, but we need to watch the limit on the facilities that we saw already. Changes to interest period, if there's a disruption rate and we haven't got a screen rate, we'll try and get an alternative rate. Otherwise, we have to comply with a certain procedure to try and find an alternative means for calculating the interest. This is very important. What the banks need is they need repayment of principal and they need payment of interest during term. The bank's profit is the margin. They only receive that if the company stays in business and continues to make payment. The banks don't make a profit on repayment of principal, because the principal has to get paid back into the markets because it's their outstanding liability anyway. The banks need the margin. That's the bank's profit. So we just have different provisions governing the calculation of the interest, alternative interest, so we can ensure that there's always a relevant applicable rate at any time. And there's the break cost clause that I mentioned before in 11.4. Fees, there's a commitment fee to make available the total facility. There's an arrangement fee paid to the arranging bank, the lead bank, and there's an agency fee paid for the agent bank for its administrative work undertaken under the facilities. We have tax gross-up clauses. All of this we want to be paid free of tax. If there is a tax gross-up, you calculate the total amount against which, when the tax is deducted in advance, which is what tax grossing up is for. It's when you have withholding taxes, which means the banks have to pay to the Inland Revenue and don't receive the full amount they would otherwise have received. If you, for example, grossing up 100 and it's a 10% withholding, that has to be grossed up to 111, so that when you take 10% of 111, that's 11. You take 11 off 111, you get 100. So the bank receives what it expected originally, free of the withholding. We'll have additional charges. There's a tax indemnity, and then there's stamp taxes as well. Then there's other adjustments made for any other particular local inland revenue rules which may apply. We try to have payments made free of VAT. If there's increased costs, borrower has to pay, although there's exceptions. Any other indemnities, borrower has to pay. Currency indemnity clause, other indemnities, indemnity to the agent, and then we'll see in 26 there's a separate provision for the banks to indemnify the agent as well. Mitigation, the lenders have to take reasonable steps to mitigate any expenses so it's reduced insofar as possible, otherwise the borrower doesn't have to pay. So there's an exception to that extent if the lenders haven't made reasonable efforts to mitigate any charges that may otherwise arise. And then again, other costs and expenses, borrower still has to pay. Transaction expenses, amendment costs, and enforcement costs. The simplest way to deal with this is on the one-page table I've given you. Simply draw lines. You can see how all of this comes together. There are approximately 18 separate charges that the borrowers will pay under the facility. That includes, again, for example, the guarantees and indemnities. A guarantee is different from an indemnity. A guarantee is you pay when the primary obligation hasn't been discharged, so it's conditional on the primary obligation not being paid. If the primary obligation is abandoned or removed or cancelled for some reason, the guarantee automatically falls. An indemnity is a larger, wider obligation to cover any losses which may arise in defined circumstances. So an indemnity is more general, wider than a guarantee. We then have a series of standard guarantee type clauses that you would expect in commercial documentation. This is essentially to do with things like continuity, no waiver, no need to make prior enforcement against somebody else. There's a series of standard clauses that we would always expect, and all of these are provided for in 18. We then have the obligations. We've mentioned the CPs in Schedule 2, incorporated through 5.1 utilisation requests. We then have the separate legal representations in 19, and then the financial representations and warranties in 20. We have a number of key standard provisions: status, binding obligations, no conflict, power and authority, validity and admissibility, governing law, so that ties to the governing law clause at the very end. Look for these connections all the way through the document. No deduction of tax, no filing or stamp duties, no default, very important. That ties back again to 5. No misleading information, that's misrepresentation, and that ties back into the default clauses we'll see. Financial statements, pari passu, no proceedings threatened or pending. This is a very important clause. Almost all large companies and governments will have outstanding litigation. It's not that there's litigation, it's that there's litigation which may impede the ability to service and perform under the documentation. It's an important clause, you need to read it. There's about 5 separate provisions, sub-clauses in here. No litigation, arbitration or administrative proceedings, so very wide. Before any court, arbitral body or other agency, very, very wide. You see, so it opens up very big. Which, if and only if, so condition, adversely determined, so only if there's an adverse determinant, might reasonably, so again, you already qualify this, might reasonably be expected to have a material adverse effect. So then we need to go back to the beginning. We need to look for the material adverse effect clause. We've got both a material adverse effect definition and we'll have a separate material adverse change clause in the defaults. So with a MAC and a ME. They're basically almost the same thing. They're intended to deal with the same problem, although you can see them used in slightly different ways in practice. We see this most commonly in acquisition finance. You have material adverse effect clauses. In those situations, the purpose is to allow the banks and the corporate acquirers to move away from the deal in the event of a change of circumstances before the acquisition. So it's effectively pre-deal. A material adverse effect clause allows you to walk away pre-deal. In this case, material adverse change clauses are more afterwards. If there's a financial change in the condition of the borrower, such that the borrower can no longer perform under the deal, we can walk away in that case. So you have facility agreements and acquisition agreements. This is a facility agreement rather than acquisition agreement. Acquisition agreements, it tends to be pre-deal. Facility tends to be post-deal. Very often, we treat them the same: material adverse effect, material adverse event, and material adverse change, although we need to look at the specific definitions. There's been some recent case law on this, and I'll put links to that on the system. These are important provisions. We need to watch them. We need to be careful. But again, another qualification: to the best of knowledge and belief. So it's not an absolute condition. It's to the best of knowledge and belief, and it's reasonably expected, has been started or threatened. And that's very important. It's not just that litigation or another process has started, it's been threatened. And that's very often where this could trigger default in practice. You need to watch this. So that's a very important clause. It's only 5 lines, but there's 5 key elements in that. 3 of them make it much wider, 2 of them qualify its operation. But a lot of that we need to go back and change our material, check our material adverse effect definition, and then we'll also read that with our material adverse change clause later in the defaults. And then we have a repetition clause. So we repeat these reps, and we saw that repetition reference. We've then got the information reps and warranties, so the financial statements. And we'll just check, is this GAAP or is this IFRS? And then remember, this is supported by the financial covers. Interestingly, the financial reps and warranties and the covers follow each other rather than are split. So in my chapter, I've split them, because we have the legal and the financials, and then we have the corporates and the financials for the covs and the reps and Ws. In the LME, they follow each other, which makes them easier to read together. number of standard provisions, the number of standard clauses. Then there's the financial covenants there. I'll give you some sample language for this. It's the typical provisions I showed you before and in my chapter, minimum net worth, the EBITDA, earnings before tax, depreciation and amortization. And that might be enough, but we can reinforce that. Consolidated net debt, payment restrictions, cash restrictions, leverage restrictions. And then we have the general undertakings are the corporate covs. So authorizations, compliance, and then that cross refers back again to the reps and to other provisions. And then the negative pledge, we always check the negative pledge, check its scope, check the definition of security and indebtedness, and then check the exceptions. The most important thing very often are the exceptions, because otherwise it's going to be too easy to trigger the negative pledge. Disposals, mergers without consent, change of business. We need to watch all of these, see how all of this applies in practice. We're then going to reinforce all of that with the events of default. And we'll see here, we have a series of standard default clauses, non-payment, breach of financial covenants, other obligations, misrepresentation, cross-default. Always look at the cross-default, which is in 23.5. There's the cross-default. Very important. You need to be able to advise your client on this. You need to ensure it's tight enough, but not too tight. We also have insolvency, insolvency proceedings, creditor process, ownership. Goes back to the change provisions we saw earlier. Any other unlawfulness, and we also saw that in terms of prepayment with illegality there, so you can cross-refer to that. And then if there's any repudiation, and then the MAC clause. I'll give you some standard MAC provisions. Again, it's the same issue always. We want it to be as wide as possible, but not too wide that it automatically triggers. It triggers too easy, because then that can also trigger the cross-default. And then remedies. As I've already explained, we can suspend further drawdown, cancel further drawdown, cancel all drawdown, and then your acceleration, rescission, and damages. Changes to lender standard clauses, changing to finance parties standard clauses, then very important provisions in 26. We're going to appoint the agent bank to act on behalf of all of the parties. We've got the duties of the agent bank in 26.2. We've got the role of the agent, the arranger, and no fiduciary duties in 26.3 and 4. The arranger has no duties of any form, any obligations under this deal, so it's got no liability. And also, neither the agent bank nor the arranging bank are fiduciaries in any way, so there's no fiduciary liability there as well. So these are strict no-duty clauses, so therefore there's no liability. That's what this is for. We then expand the operations and entitlements of the agent bank. It's appointed under 26.1. We'll expand that in 26.5 and 6. There's limited majority voting, and if there's majority voting, it's only on a 66 3/4 two-thirds basis. That's 26.7. Responsibility, 26.8. And then exclusion of liability, 9. And then, very important, we have the liability clause, which is in 26.9b. Only if there's gross negligence or willful misconduct can there be any liability under this agreement. You always look at that clause, see what it says. It's very important indeed. And then most of the rest of it's pretty standard. So conduct of business by the parties, sharing as pari passu. Watch 28, the exceptions in 28.5. Most important part, can one of the banks get additional payments and retain those payments? And then the rest of it, again, is very straightforward. Administrative clauses, set-off. We disapply set-off for the borrowers. We retain set-off for the lenders. Notices, calculations and certificates, partial invalidity, remedies and waivers, amendments and waivers, and then key clause, governing law and enforcement. We've also already mentioned most of the schedules. They will apply to the parties, the conditions precedent, the utilisation requests, mandatory cost formula. Schedule 5 will be a novation, transfer by novation. Schedule 6, transfer by assignment. Then you've got accession letters, resignation letters, compliance certificates in 9, existing security, disclosure for the negative pledge in 10, confidentiality in 11, timetables in 12. And with all of that, we can understand this very important document, which not only governs, it's the key provision which applies in a $90 to $100 trillion market, but the same provisions will then be used in other multiple financial centres around the world, as well as in multiple other credit loan-based type facilities. If you understand this and the relationship between all the different provisions, how it all works and operates in practice, you'll understand almost any other type of key banking type provision or facility.